Case number 16-7107. Gary E. Johnson et al. Appellants versus Commission on Presidential Debates et al. Mr. Fine for the appellants, Mr. Loss for the appellees.
May it please the court, my name is Bruce Fine and I'm representing the appellants, including Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, who are presidential candidates in 2012. With me is my partner, Bruce Lavalle, who's also a member of the Bar of this court. Thank you. Your Honor, this case comes procedurally in the context of a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b1 and 12b6, where all of the factual allegations in the complaint must be accepted as true. And those factual allegations, which are buttressed by Exhibit 1 to the complaint, are that in 2012, the nominees of the Democratic and Republican parties, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, in conjunction with the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is a joint venture of the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee, agreed that the nominees of the two major parties would debate only under the auspices of the Commission on Presidential Debates, meaning, for example, they wouldn't agree to debate if the League of Women Voters wanted to host them, that they would boycott any joint appearances in any format with any other candidate, and that they would agree on what is commonly called in the briefs a 15% polling threshold as a condition for an invitation to participate in the debates, in addition to a requirement that a participant have qualified on sufficient state ballots to have a mathematical chance of winning an electoral college majority. And as the record shows, if they had stuck with simply the electoral college threshold, there would have been four rather than two participants in the debate.
Counsel, I would like to pursue some of the standing issues in this case. There are three requirements, were there not, for qualification for the debate. One was a constitutional problem, that is to say you had to meet a certain age. Two, you had to qualify on enough ballots to enough states to be possible as an election. And three, 15%. Why wouldn't somebody be able to challenge the second requirement, the requirement that you be on enough state ballots to qualify as president?
It may well be that they might have standing to do
they
that.
They would have standing
they,
to.
Not necessarily, because Bell v. Hood teaches that if you've just concocted a very frivolous claim, there's a fine line between a 12b6 and a 12b1 motion.
Well, perhaps, but if they would have had standing on that, why wouldn't any citizen in the United States have standing just as your clients?
Well, not everyone runs for president of the United States.
They don't have to, do they?
They'd have to show some kind of injury.
Well, they would show that if I could get into the debates, then I would run. Or I would just announce beforehand, and once I get into the debate, boy, then I would get all the
votes. Well, maybe, and I think what the scrap case teaches is that you could dismiss that on summary judgment in the scrap case, and that's how you would handle this. It's a frivolous complaint. You move for summary judgment. There's no facial plausibility to those particular allegations that in fact,
was going to happen. It's the same injury, is it not? Any American who wanted to be in the debates and couldn't get in the debates would have the same injury.
Not necessarily for purposes of subject matter jurisdiction. If you go back to Bell versus Hood, Justice Black says that if the 12b6 claim is so frivolous and you've just concocted it just to get into court, you can dismiss it for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
No, I would concoct it just to get into the debate.
No, I'm saying that the claim on the merits is so tenuous that you could dismiss it for lack of subject matter jurisdiction if it's clear there's very little substance that you've in fact suffered an injury that would satisfy a successful attack on the reasonableness standard of that particular qualification.
I see your response in that. What about, what relief are you seeking?
Here, Your Honor, we're seeking damages and possibly, if we prevailed on the merits, seeking some possible dissolution of the Commission on Presidential Debates, because we argue it's a monopoly.
That's an injunction you're asking for.
That would be an injunction down the road if that was appropriate relief.
With respect, did you explicitly ask for an injunction?
In the complaint? Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, all right. Now, that would depend on future underlines. That would depend on future plans to get into debate?
Well, not the theory would be, Your Honor, that this is an essential facilities and that because they're so conflicted, that dissolving the what
but
we consider the monopoly.
But you have to show that you're planning to go into the debates the next time.
You would have to have some showing of
You have any such statement in your complaint?
Your Honor, at that particular time, there weren't any debates scheduled, so we don't know whether there'll be debates in 2020. It's not like it's part of the official government calendar. It's up to the CPD to decide to schedule debates.
The relief you're seeking has to be something in the future, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so therefore you have to underline show that you have an intention.
If we have to go back,
you haven't alleged that.
Yes, that is correct. We can't get an injunction for the future unless there's some concrete possibility that we would be having a debate. We confront this particular issue. How can we say we have an intent to participate, say, in the 2020 debates? They aren't even scheduled yet. They may not occur at all. How can you have an intent to participate in something that hasn't even been scheduled?
You just undermine your own request for an injunction.
It just
that
the question
well
is your relief too speculative? I think that's
that
the concern.
That particular form of relief may be too speculative. I mean, our major effort to get relief is to have an examination on the merits of the reasonableness of the 15% threshold. We think we have monetary damages. That's what happened in 2020. There's nothing speculative about that. And if we go to the argument that you were presenting, Judge Shelburne, this is a very sound one. Well, what about standing? One of the arguments made by the district court was that we didn't have standing because our pre-existing flaw was that we didn't satisfy the 15% threshold, and therefore there was no injury. Well, true enough, but then that theory, nobody would ever have standing because they would say the reason why you have an injury is you didn't satisfy the threshold that you claim is illegal.
You correctly point out that conflates the merits with the standing issue.
Yes, Your Honor. And then there are other elements that come into play with regard to why there's no standing.
What about antitrust standing?
The antitrust
now,
standing.
Now that deals only with the antitrust issue.
The Article III standing issue. Yes, there's antitrust.
No, I'm putting aside the Article III for a moment and looking at antitrust standing.
Okay. The antitrust standing is we argue that the injury to competition as opposed to the injury to the competitors, because we understand that's what you have to allege, is that what is the market out here when you're running for president? You're distributing information about presidential candidates. That's what candidates do. This is what I'm going to do. This is what my opponent's going to do. And that information market was diminished. Competition was hurt there because you arbitrarily excluded with the purpose of destroying the ability of rival candidates who satisfied a credible public support standard of having their information distributed. So it's an output limitation.
Excuse me. If the market is a political market.
No, we argue, Your Honor.
You lose, right?
We argue that...
Yeah, that's correct. If it's a political market, you lose.
If it has no commercial impact, because if you look at Allied Tube and the Superior Court Trial Lawyers Association, they suggest there are oftentimes situations where there's a convergence of commercial and political markets, if you will. Just because it has a political impact doesn't mean it has a commercial element. And let's look at the Sear report.
That doesn't quite get you there, does it? You're talking about lawyers boycotting, there's a market of lawyers getting paid for their services. The market is relatively well-defined. And here your brief defines the market as the multi-billion-dollar business of campaigning for the presidency. Who is buying what? And at which the price for what is getting affected? Whose price?
Well, I think if you give me your honor, indulge just a second here, with regard to the Superior Court case, there, what was being done by the lawyers was to get the government to raise the price. There was, you know, it didn't, it wasn't bribery. It wasn't saying the government in quid pro quo, the government will, you know, negotiate a deal with the trial lawyers. They got the government to act. That was political action, but it had a commercial element to it. It's like arguing the government should raise the minimum wage. It's political action, but it has a commercial element to it, on, you know, just as it did in Superior Court. And you, to your specific question, Judge Pillard, what is the market? The market, the recipients of the presidential information, what do they get? Well, they can make contributions, they can donate time, they can speak on behalf of a particular candidate. It's not wholly dissimilar to asking, you know, what does a student get in a university? They get exposure to ideas, right? So what do they do with the ideas? Well, you know, they pay tuition that it costs them to get into the university. But they do. They get educated. They have access to information. They can use it in a whole host of ways that they may choose to do so.
So they're buying a product, which is an education and the degree that comes with it. Who is buying what here?
Well, no one is. If you notice that in our brief, we cite a known large campaign contributor, Betsy DeVos. She's now the Secretary of Education. And the DeVoses gave large sums of money to candidates, and they interviewed her and said, well, what are you getting? You know, what's in it? What are you getting for your donation? She says, well, we're getting the policies that we want. We expect, and she used the term, that's our return on investment. Now, it's surely true, Your Honor, that if it was just bribery, if they said, hey, here's the money, you know, we're selling you our presidential, you know, information, give us money in exchange, and we'll use it. Then you run into FEC issues and whether you can make contributions or things like that. But we don't think that it's disqualified from a market that has commercial objectives and goals simply because the recipients, the immediate recipients of the information, you know, aren't engaged in a transaction that we call commerce. But sometimes it is. Donald Trump hats. The candidates sell merchandise. It's a commercial transaction. Donald Trump made billions of dollars.
But that's not the objective of your suit. What is the commercial objective and goal? It's that a candidate can spend a year being paid by a committee that is a sum of the public donations. And it's like that well, candidate can have a gap year on the.
No, I think let's take the analogy to the Superior Court case. You know, what was the goal in Superior Court that the court characterized as commercial? The goal was to get the government to enact a law that would hike the compensation for criminal justice attorney appointees for services. Goals of presidential candidates all the time have similar goals. We want to increase the minimum wage. We want to decrease taxes. We want to open up oil pipelines that have commercial objectives. Under Superior Court, those are commercial goals. And the way you execute them is getting government to act. And what Superior Court teaches is that if the goal, even if it requires the government to act, has a commercial element to it, the means by which you get to the goal, that is the means by which you are able to get into office or pressure the government, then is subject to the antitrust laws. And that's the gist of what our argument is here. The means by which you're deciding or involved in campaigning for the president, including especially presidential debates, become subject to the antitrust laws. And I want to underscore, Your Honor, that at this particular stage, there has been no examination of whether or not the 15% threshold is reasonable, unreasonable. They have never got there. Just said, you're out no matter whether the threshold could be 60% or 55%. I see I've overstepped my time. I wanted to reserve 3 minutes. I don't know whether I can come back with your indulgence, Judge Brown, to respond.
We will decide how much rebuttal time you get.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Lou Loss. I'm counsel for the Commission on Presidential Debates, Frank Fahrenkopf and Mike McCurry. I'm speaking today on behalf of my clients, as well as the other appellees, Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, the Republican National Committee, and the Democratic National Committee. With me today, counsel table, is my colleague, Uzoma Nkwanda. I think that the legal defects and significant legal principles that preclude this suit from going forward are particularly clear, well addressed by the district court, and we certainly had ample opportunity in our briefing to review them. So I think, in addition to responding to any questions that the court has, I'd like to focus in on 2 points. The first is the one that the court expressed some interest in its questioning and that Mr. Fine was just addressing. It seems to us extremely clear that this is a political lawsuit. The actions that are being challenged are core political decisions that are also quintessential speech protected by the First Amendment.
How do you distinguish the trial lawyer's case?
The trial lawyer's case, it was a commercial boycott of providing services that had as a goal inducing some political action to provide higher wages for those folks. But those lawyers were engaged in a commercial boycott. The decisions that are being challenged here.
What is your response to his point that all political demands include all political programs include a range of economic questions?
Well,
like minimum wage and so forth.
I think it's in the Knorr case where that's.
Ms. What?
I think it's in the Knorr case where the Supreme Court addressed this, and it would undercut democracy if folks couldn't come together in common cause to try to persuade their government to adopt a particular policy. It would infringe the First Amendment for the government to interfere with that kind of political speech. And the case law is very clear that in order to fall within the ambit of the antitrust laws, the conduct that's at issue has to be commercial conduct. All of the commercial aspects of campaigning for the presidency that are collected very well by appellants are incidental, and those aren't the decisions that are at issue here.
In other words, your distinction between the trial lawyer's case and this case is the trial lawyer's case, the overwhelming objective is economic. It has a political aspect, but its objective is economic.
Absolutely.
In this case, the overwhelming objective is political. It has some ancillary economic aspects. That's your point?
Exactly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, what about the Article III question?
Well, I think there's a significant standing problem here, as the district court found, and as the district court found in Filani, and this court found in Filani on appeal. And
let's assume every American citizen has the same injury. Is that still? Do they still have standing then? That isn't a generalized grievance, is it? Because it's not abstract.
Well,
under Aikens.
I think there are multiple problems from a standing perspective. The first is I don't think every citizen or these appellants have a cognizable legal injury under the McConnell case. Their fundamental grievance is that they were not able to compete on what they would call a level playing field.
Well, no, wait a minute. You would be better off studying everybody had the same thing. Now I'm really puzzled. Wouldn't you be better off saying everybody has the same thing and then argue it's a generalized grievance?
Well, if everybody has it, nobody does.
Excuse me. Right. I was going through all three elements. I do think it would be a generalized grievance, and if everybody has it, that shows the absurdity of permitting this case to go forward. Your hypo also highlights that these appellants have not argued they would have won the presidency. They're not going to try to show, if this case were to go forward, that but for their exclusion from the debates.
Well, they're not going to do that because that makes it strictly a political case, and then they're out.
Right, but my point is going to be that their injury is the same that every citizen would be able to argue, is that they wanted to be heard.
The other 200 people, certainly, who wanted to run for president would be in the same position.
Exactly.
But I think maybe everybody is in the same position, because if I wanted to be in the debates, I would have made a lot of money.
Well, we'd be happy to consider your candidacy, Your Honor.
It would seem
that... Is there an age limit for the president?
I don't think you're too young, Your Honor.
It would seem that the appellants here have a much more focused claim, though. They're saying it is the, I mean, you have to look for standing at what they're challenging, and therefore, were they to succeed on the merits, what would they gain? Not what someone else in a broader, with a broader claim and a lower threshold would get. I mean, that seems to me that's what distinguishes this case from Filani. It's one thing to say, well, if the nonprofit status of the debate sponsoring organization were removed, then maybe and maybe and maybe. Whereas here they're saying all we're after is get rid of that 15% threshold, and there's only a very small group of candidates who would additionally be part of the debates were that to happen. And the likelihood seems quite high, in contrast to Filani, that the debates would go on with the slightly larger field. And so that's, I think, their case on what reduces the speculativeness. And what's your response to that?
There are several. The if you look at footnote 8 of our brief, we list some of the candidates in the last 20 or 30 years who have achieved ballot access sufficient to have a theoretical electoral college majority. I think you will see when you review that list of names that there are a number of names that it's really hard to imagine that the major party candidates would have agreed to share the stage with candidates who enjoyed such modest public support. Further, and let me just say as a policy matter, the CPD has spent countless hours on these candidate selection criteria and trying to figure out the best way to do it. And we have looked hard at exactly this approach. What if he just went with the standard that these appellants want? The problem is, while gaining ballot access in enough states to have a theoretical electoral college majority is no small accomplishment, A, it says nothing about public interest in the actual candidate. It's an organizational and financing undertaking. B, if you made that the ticket into the televised general election debates, many more candidates would actually go out and accomplish that. It would be completely unworkable. And
well,
I would also
you might not win. I mean, they might not win on the merits, but for purposes of standing,
well, I think there is a
like
real
the. I mean, even the handful in footnote 8, and they do point to precedents with, you know, Perot being in and Anderson being in, and I mean, you know, there's going to be some coverage.
Let me address the Anderson example because I think it's instructive and it actually shows how speculative it is to think that they would get the relief that they seek from a standing perspective. In 1980, the League of Women Voters sponsored the debates and used the same 15% standard that is challenged here. First presidential, at the time of the first presidential debate, John Anderson satisfied it. He was invited to participate in the debates. President Carter refused to participate in that debate. This is a matter of public record. So there was a debate just between Governor Reagan and John Anderson. Later, after the debate, also somewhat contrary to what appellants would have you think happens if you participate in a debate, John Anderson's support fell dramatically. He did not qualify for participation in the next debate. So it is highly speculative to think that even at 15%, that they necessarily would result in a there's some question. There's some question even at 15%.
Isn't that going with the merits, not standing?
Well, I think history shows us that it's speculative to think that that a major party candidate would agree to participate
in a candidate.
Well, wait a minute.
If I understand their case, mm-hmm. it is not the likelihood of winning an election that is their damage. It's the economic consequences of being kept out of the debate, the economic consequences which would flow from selling hats and things like that.
But it all hinges on them being in a debate with the leading candidates.
Right.
And
they can be in the debate. But that's got nothing to do, that doesn't have to do with their chances of winning the election, does it?
Agreed. Totally agree.
So that it seems to me that someone who has, say, 30% on the polls, but has not qualified in enough states to be elected president, would still have the same injury. I think that's a helpful question.
Right. That is true. Of course,
because if I had 30%, I would say, look, I may not have enough. We qualified in enough states, but boy, would I cause a lot of trouble and would I be able to sell a lot of hats if I had 30%? So I want to challenge the reasonableness of the other standard.
And it seems to me you would have standing, a person in that position would have standing. They would lose perhaps on the merits,
right,
which is
exactly.
A separate question. I mean, I'm just reading the cases and thinking about, there's no question raised about standing in Arkansas Educational TV v. Forbes, in Johnson versus FEC. Even if you think about the St. Patrick's Day parade case, Hurley, nobody said, oh, you don't have standing because if you join the parade, we might not have a parade, you know. You could make that argument, but it seemed that the criterion that was being challenged was the hurdle to keeping that, you know, that kept that party out, and we have a similar kind of structure here. So I just I wonder if you could square with those cases, or Celebrezzi, or there are just so many cases where we have a similar structure.
I think I can.
Okay.
You might note that we haven't moved to have the case dismissed as to the First Amendment claim on standing grounds. And the cases to which you refer were constitutional cases, First Amendment cases. And our understanding of the case law, and certainly Johnson versus FCC bears this out, is that were there a violation of the First Amendment, that creates its own cognizable injury.
What about redressability? Now, here's what I find a little puzzling.
Mm-hmm.
If an order were issued to allow the plaintiffs to be in the next debate or damages for not having been in the last debate, there is a question whether this would encroach upon the First Amendment rights of Romney and Obama. Is that a redressability issue for standing? You understand my question?
Mm.
In other words, if it is determined that an order directing the new debate or the old debate to include the plaintiffs would interfere with the First Amendment rights of Romney and Obama, which you could argue.
Right.
With that, does that go to redressability for standing on First Amendment?
I think it does, and I think it
also. Would you make that argument? Well, it doesn't matter because if it's a standing issue, we raise it on our own.
And it's true as to the Commission on Presidential Debates as well. We have First Amendment rights, as the Court recognized in Perot, and it would encroach upon the CPD's First Amendment
rights. Is that a merits issue or is that a standing question because it reflects on the redressability of the Court? I wasn't sure of the answer to that.
I think it's sometimes difficult to sort out when it is a merits question and when it is a standing question.
You know, I knew it was difficult. I expected help from you.
I will tell you this. When the law is as clear as this law is with respect to the First Amendment rights of the appellees, I think it is appropriate to address it as a standing question and not solely as a merits issue.
Well, I'll ask the other side on that.
The final point that I wanted to make is this. Mr. Fine said in his presentation that the relief they actually seek in response to Judge Silberman's questioning is they just want the reasonableness of these criteria to be reviewed. Well, they don't get to jump over all these important legal principles under the First Amendment and the antitrust laws to get that review. Now, that doesn't mean there is nowhere they can go. In fact, the Federal Election Commission regulates the sponsorship of presidential debates and other debates for federal office. They have regulations governing candidate selection criteria. And if there is a procedure for any person aggrieved to file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission and then to obtain judicial review if they wish at the conclusion of the FEC's process. In fact, the Libertarian Party and the Green Party, appellants here, have filed such a complaint. The FEC has addressed it once. It went up to the district court. It was remanded. The Federal Election Commission just recently addressed it again. It includes a reasonableness review of the 15% criterion, and if they wish, the parties in that case can seek further judicial review. There is an avenue open for them, and important legal principles need not be bent beyond their breaking point to accommodate the desire for some review.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fine had no time left. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. Just to respond to the last remarks by my opponent here, it seems to me inconsistent to say on the one hand the First Amendment protects absolutely the right of CPD and Obama and Romney to decide the debate format, and then on the other hand saying, but the FEC, acting under statute, can challenge and penetrate the First Amendment right. The Constitution trumps the statute, whether it's an antitrust law or an FEC
law. Well, now, what about the concern? Suppose we conclude that President Obama and Governor Romney had a First Amendment right to debate as they wished without excluding others. And does that go to the redressability, which is one element of standing?
I think it goes to the merits, Your Honor, but I want to point out...
Why doesn't it go to redressability?
Because the question is, if they don't...
Even if we concluded that you might have a First Amendment claim, if we conclude that Romney and Obama have a First Amendment claim not to be... not to debate by themselves, then aren't we faced with a redressability question for you, therefore a standing question for you?
Well, yes, but it merges into the merits, Your Honor, because you have to decide the First Amendment issue on the merits.
And
I think, Your Honor, the Associated Press case addresses your question, you know, thoroughly.
Really.
Associated Press, the argument was made by forcing Associated Press to permit members to come in, have access, and to prevent APUs.
That was strictly a commercial case.
No, if you look at Justice Black's opinion, and we've reproduced it in our brief, he doesn't ever mention the word commercial there. He says it's a First Amendment values that are at stake in deciding that they're not going to accept that authority of AP to say, you can kick everybody else out because you're involved in, his words, news and views, like news and ideas. And he says that's the reason why you have no First Amendment right to say you don't want to deal and sell your AP news to anybody but your members, and you can automatically veto anyone else. And his passage, he never even hints at commerce being the touchstone of his decision. With regard to the statement that was made that the commission is involved in trying to elicit what public interest there would be in the participants, the fact is they don't use a public interest standard to calculate the 15%. As we point out in our brief, in the year 2000, almost two-thirds to three-quarters of the members of the public said they wanted Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan in the debates. Nowhere. In 1996, after Ross Perot got 19% of the vote in 1992, after he participated in debates and rose from 7% to 19%, the two major party nominees said, you're out. Can't come in, even though he had 19%. So the standard isn't just voter interest. We allege the standard is what can strengthen the dominance of the two major parties and make certain that there's as little encroachment as possible on the major party nominees in running for the president. And I think, Your Honor, you're also correct in noting that our grievance isn't purely, it's not we didn't win the election. Also, even if you just capture substantial support, you can have an influence on those economic issues that you addressed that are part of every campaign. For example, Ross Perot, he didn't win in 1992, but he injected balanced budgets. And those who are around here during the Clinton administration, he made balanced budget a cornerstone of his agenda, and he touted it as a major accomplishment. And that was there because Ross Perot was permitted to participate in those issues. But I appreciate Your Honor for the extra time, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fine. The case will be submitted.